We are back. Bill Russell and I, Paula Gordon, are talking with Brian Green. We are talking about an elegant universe. Well, the reason I want to talk about math is I was quite struck in your book, The Elegant Universe, that you talk about how physicists have been borrowing from mathematicians for a really long time. And that math, you might be able to begin to repay some of your debt to math, but you also say that these are two culturally very different endeavors, and his eyes get big. This stuff is all so weird to those on the outside that, I mean, physics looks inaccessible and math looks inaccessible, but you guys can't talk either?
Right. There is a cultural divide between mathematicians and physicists. It's being broken down, finally, in the last few years. It's starting to come down. But for many years, the divide was there and rather significant because mathematicians tend to only want to go on to the next step in their research when all previous steps have been completely understood, they've worked out all the details, and now they're ready to move on to the next step. Physicists are kind of more wild.
You're the cowboys.
That's right. Willing to run roughshod over research and sort of basically get the idea of what they're currently working on, not necessarily complete it, but go on to the next step and the next step beyond that. And the reason is, perhaps, and this is often the case, when we get to the fourth or fifth step down the line, we realize, hey, this isn't working, it's not relevant to the world around us, and let's abandon this path completely. And it's better to abandon it after working on a few months as opposed to working out every detail of every step and then getting 10 years down the line saying, oh, this isn't exactly what we had in mind. Now, mathematicians often don't come up upon that because they're not trying to compare their work to the world, to nature, to the universe. Whatever they produce, if it's solid work, it is mathematics, and it is a development in math, and they're pleased with it because they don't have to match nature. And therefore, we have this additional constraint, and I think that's what drives us to kind of get the rough idea first. If it looks like it could work, let's pursue it. If not, let's chuck it without working out the details. It's not worth it.
You are both constrained, but you also have the opportunity to test, which is, I mean, mathematicians can create all sorts of wonderful structures that frequently have nothing to do with anything. And in fact, part of the resource that you've been able to draw on are these wonderful edifices, mathematical edifices that were sitting out there that people, you know, somebody
had
created.
And how do you pronounce those? The thing with the hyphen that ends with Y-A-U.
Kalabiyau.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's the name of the shapes into which the extra dimensions in string theory can be curled up into. It turns out that they can't be squashed together into any shape at all. They have to be a member of this particular class.
And those were mathematical
constructs,
right? Yeah, those
are two. That's right. There's a mathematician named Kalabi. I think he's at University of Pennsylvania, and Xingtang Yao at Harvard, and their work prior to string theory on these shapes turns out was very, very useful to string theorists who could go and borrow their mathematical results and apply them to the physics of this theory. So that's a good example of how math was developed without any care for its application to the world around us. Then a physical theory comes along which needs exactly that math, and luckily for us, it was already developed.
That raises an interesting question. Are there other spaces? Have you explored other spaces? Have mathematicians explored other spaces that might be appropriate? Because essentially what you talk about within the context of those, that particular articulation of mathematical articulation of space. Are there others?
Well, mathematicians have worked out the mathematics behind an enormous number of different kinds of shapes. And in fact, mathematicians have cataloged, they've classified almost all possible shapes of a certain variety that they're able to get their mathematics around. Most of those, we think, are totally irrelevant for the universe. But it turns out that this one subclass, this Kalabiyau class, seems to be relevant. So an interesting thing is it true that any and all mathematics that's ever developed will ultimately have some relevance to physics? I don't think so, although not all physicists agree. There's some who say if it's good mathematics, ultimately the universe is going to make use of it in some manner. Hmm. What we have found so far is that there are branches of mathematics that no one ever thought would have any relevance to physics, and they do. And moreover, as you were briefly indicating, we've also found that physics is starting to indicate new branches of mathematics that need to be explored. So a lot of mathematicians are turning to physicists to get inspiration. And then once they have that inspiration, they're then using mathematical tools to go further in a direction that's pointed to by physics.
What you're saying sounds a little bit like the duality that you describe, that the possibility that the same mathematical function could describe different mathematical functions could describe the same reality.
Right. Right. One of the key ideas of modern science is that you can perhaps have two different physical theories. They look different on paper, but my God, when you look at them close enough in terms of their predictions about how the universe works, they say the same thing. It's not quite like having English and French, two translations of a book. You look at them at first sight, if you don't speak one or the other language, they look totally different. But finally, when you learn both languages, you say, hey, they're all saying the same thing. It's like that, but it's a little more powerful, because it turns out that when you have these two different ways of thinking about the universe, oftentimes you can get a profound insight from one viewpoint that you simply couldn't have gotten from the other.
Isn't that sort of like the work you do as a physicist, as a practicing physicist, with your flops, which I don't understand at all, but isn't that in the same domain of you can look at something two ways and it is different and the same?
To some extent, yes. So what you're referring to is a discovery which I was fortunately to be involved with, and having to do with how the fabric of the universe can evolve. And what we found is that whereas Einstein said the fabric of space can expand, and in fact we've seen this, we know that galaxies are moving apart, and we believe that that is a function of the fabric itself expanding as time evolves, we have found that there are more exotic evolutions that the fabric of space can undergo. So the fabric of anything, if you stretch it enough, it'll rip. And the question is, or at least one that occurred to us, is can the fabric of the universe rip? And we found that in the context of string theory, the answer is yes, the fabric can rip. And that has to do with these things called flops. That's the technical term that allows that allows the fabric to tear apart. And indeed, when the fabric does tear, you can sort of examine the universe on both sides of the tear, and in some sense get two different perspectives on the same physical universe, one on one side of the tear, one on the other. And yes, that can be a very powerful set of new insights that come from making use of both of those perspectives simultaneously.
You suggest that we could conceivably be undergoing a transition of that sort if it were occurring slowly enough. How would we know?
Right. So can these tears in the spatial fabric occur today, right? Could we be on the brink of a tear in the spatial fabric? Could it be happening as we speak right now? And the theory says that indeed it could be happening, because the key thing of string theory is that, unlike in Einstein's theory, where if the fabric were to tear, there'd be a cosmic calamity, some major explosion or something would completely go haywire, a reason why Einstein said the fabric can't tear, because he didn't think the universe could go haywire. What we found in string theory is that when the fabric tears, nothing too dramatic happens. And it's not that it makes the tears boring, it makes them incredibly exciting. It's one of the rare times that a little physical consequence is a reason for great excitement, because we now learn that the fabric can tear because it doesn't lead to a cosmic calamity. Now, you might say it doesn't lead to anything, and it does. What can happen is the masses of the particles in the world around us can shift slightly. So the electron weighs a certain amount, and we know what it does. If the universe were to suffer one of these rips, it could be that the mass of the electron would shift slightly. Now, no experiment has shown such a shift as yet, so it's unlikely that those tears are happening. But as I mentioned in the book, if they're happening very, very slowly, then the change in the mass of the electron would also be very, very slow, perhaps so slow that experiment can't yet detect it. So those tears could possibly be happening today. I think it's more likely that they would have occurred in the very early universe, when things were hot and wild and frenetic and the universe was rapidly expanding and so forth. Those are the times when the extra dimensions could have been evolving with rips and tears and so forth. Perhaps by today they've kind of settled down to a quiescent placid state, but nothing assures that that's the case.
Well, and this goes, I think, to your point about the importance, potential importance of initial conditions. If you know, at some place one of those events occurred, and then as the universe stabilized early on, then we just sort of got locked into, more or less accidentally, the particular universe we inhabit with the attributes that we describe in great detail.
Right. Yeah, one of the deepest questions of science is, you know, why does the universe have the properties that we see in the world around us, and are they explainable? Right? So people have measured.
And just because is not a good answer.
Right. Well, some people say it is just because and give up. You know, the universe is how it is, but many of us want to go further. You know, why does the electron weigh what it does? Why do the quarks weigh what they do? Why does gravity have the strength that it does? It could be accident. It could be that we got locked into a universe by happenstance, but we think that there's a chance that we can go beyond simple explanations using happenstance. String theory provides us a framework, finally, for answering those questions, but again, it's going to take further research before we understand the theory well enough to extract them. But we do hope one day to be able to explain why the electron weighs what it does, why the quarks weigh what they do. And these are actually very crucial numbers, because if they change by too much from what they're currently observed, the universe as we know it goes away. stars rely upon nuclear processes that require these numbers to have very special values and special relations. If you ruin those relations, stars don't light up, and without stars, there's not a universe as we know it. So I think that perhaps is the deepest question in all of science to explain those features, those attributes of the universe, and string theory is our first hope for a framework for doing just that.
You say that your central idea in your book is that you just cannot look at any of these things without including string theory anymore.
Basically, that's right. Because ultimately, when you're describing things at their most fundamental level, you find that you come down to strings and their vibrations. And that, we believe, will be where the ultimate answers will emerge.
This is Brian Greene, and Bill's going to ask him a question when we return in just a moment.